welcome to another edition of Nucleus Investment Insights. This week, we're going to be talking about international shares by Australia. Sorry, by international, sell the rest of the world. We have
sell Australia.
So we have David Llewellyn Smith, Chief Strategist here as well. Hi, David.
G'day, Daniel. Well, listeners.
Thanks for coming on once again. So just a reminder, everything you're going to hear today is general advice in nature, doesn't constitute personal and financial advice. If you do want personal financial advice, you can book in with a call for us and we can talk you through talk to one of our financial planners. What we're going to focus on today, we're going to sort of approach this from two different angles. One is sort of some macro side of it, about reasons that international looks more attractive than Australia. And the second one is some of the individual stock exposures you can get. So some of the big themes which we've really been pushing for, where those themes are much more prevalent overseas than what they are in Australia. So Australia, you largely get the resources and banks, and we're sort of looking for more, cloud, AI, obesity, robotics, a lot of the sort of newer sort of productivity enhancing sectors, which we think should be the theme for the moment. But Dave, maybe I should jump straight to you for some of the macro reasons. Why should you be clearing out of Australia for macro purposes?
Sure. Well, I'm going to love this, of course. And, so viewers have probably seen over the last 6 months or so, you're making reference to the likelihood of another lost decade in Australia, based around some similar themes of what triggered our lost decade in the sort of period or the decade leading up to COVID. And so some of these themes will be recognisable from that period, and probably the one that we'd lead off with and the main one that really triggered a lot of Australia's problems through that profitless growth era was the big stall in China post the GFC stimulus, where Xi Jinping decided enough was enough, and suddenly choked back, especially on property in China around 2011 or 2012 when he got in. He then ebbed and flowed on it for a few years, but had a real crack at it in like 2014-15. And, we had a big terms of trade crash. This is when iron ore managed to get to $37 for a brief period. Now, that is called a terms of trade crash, and we think that we're going to rerun this over the next few years. The terms of trade is a ratio of your exports by imports, and it's really kind of a measure of your pay, I guess, or your purchasing power in the global economy. And so when the terms of trade go up, you're effectively getting a pay rise as a nation. And when they go down, you're getting a pay cut as a nation. And so national income falls. And when it's these major bulk commodities that drive so much of Australian income, national income, it falls very steeply. So once you get that, there's mechanically a flow of negatives that come with it. So nominal growth really slows a lot. You may not end up in a proper recession, but your nominal growth stalls out in a really major way. And that ends up sucking down wages, like a giant vortex, becomes very deflationary, and of course it seriously damages your domestic demand as a result. And the other thing it hits really hard is the federal budget, which, does have a very large slab of mining income in it from the tax take, and especially once again from the major commodities, the bulks, coke and coal and iron ore. So, so when that hole appears in the budget, it has to be filled with either big cuts to fiscal spending, which again is bad for domestic demand, or rising taxes, and it's usually a combination of both. And of course, that's bad for domestic demand as well in terms of holding back households who will already be struggling because of wages being sucked down. So it basically deflates your whole economy. And it's quite difficult. You know, you can get through it through various policy measures, none of which we use properly. But typically what we do instead is boost immigration. Well, that is what we did do in the last, as a policy response to the last time this happening, as a way to try and boost demand. But of course, you know, that's a labor-led boost to demand, not an investment-led boost. And then it has all sorts of implications as well that are largely negative, again, for wages. It suppresses productivity too, because you're shallowing your capital. And so you get no income growth and you get no profits. Again, it's profitless. It's growth, but it's profitless growth.
Yeah. So just to expand on that, so it's what David's talking about there in terms of the capital is Australia has a certain amount of capital and a certain amount of people. And ideally, in an economy that's going forward, you get more and more capital. You get more and more things that are in the economy doing it, whether it's factories and automation and ports and all these things that make everyone more productive, because yes, a machine does that now. We no longer need a people to do that. And so what we've done instead is we've poured lots of people in, and so our capital is actually capital per person has been falling, which is part of the productivity issue.
Exactly right. And so it's disproductive, right? You get less productive. It's funnily enough, it's quite labor intensive, because everyone ends up kind of riding a bike delivering food. And so, you just end up in this kind of weird spot where you're creating lots of labor intensive sort of bullshit jobs, I guess you would call it. But it's not good for kind of economy-wide profits or nor the stock market. What it is good for is bonds, because it's very deflationary. So there's another problem, however, in this cycle as we think that this transpires. China is like the first domino, if you like. Smashing into this, we've got AI. And now, on one front, if AI kind of delivers on its promise over the next 5 years, 10 years, then you will get some big productivity gains, which would help, Australia get through, these big income losses. However, there's a sort of distinction in these technological advances between labor enabling technology, which doesn't really cost you jobs, just makes people more efficient, and labor replacing technology. And AI is the latter, or tends towards the latter. And so you're going to lose quite a lot of services jobs in Australia over this next business cycle. And this is going to crash into this labor-led growth model, just as it's pressured by this big China stall in terms of trade falls. And so pouring labor into that scenario is going to be, I don't even know if it's sustainable, to be honest. Like, it may actually cause a political rupture around immigration. If AI were to structurally lift unemployment, for instance, then pouring immigration into those circumstances is pretty difficult. That being said, we got up to sort of, I think, about 7% unemployment after the mining boom went bust, and they still managed to pour the immigration in. So I mean, they'll almost certainly try. So again, that's deflationary.
And it's interesting as well on those labor losses front. To date, it's been mainly the white collar workers who've been losing either losing jobs or just weak hiring in those white collar workers, especially the junior end of the white collar workers. I guess my take is, I think the real disruption from a society perspective is going to when it starts to crash into some of your blue collar workers, and that's that sort of probably the driving is the key one to really watch there, because I think if it's not the most the biggest job description of being a driver, it's close to, it's one of the top job descriptions, whether it's a mixture of delivery drivers, Ubers, taxis, bus drivers, through all the different groups, truck drivers. And add them all up. It's a huge portion of the economy that is involved in that. And that's one thing to say, okay, here's somebody, a white collar person who's lost their job. They've potentially got other things they can do, or they can step down if you're in sort of a middle income, you can step down into lower middle income. But when you're already at or close to the minimum wage and you lose your job, it's obviously a lot harder than to find something else.
Yes. No, well, I mean, I do think white collar workers are capable of being angry as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I
mean, we've been very happy to admit there are many unknowns in the AI rollout. Probably the largest being speed. Like, how fast does it come? How fast does it substitute for various roles? And if it's, you know, if it takes more time to train up these models and eliminate their hallucinations and you know, get them functioning in various data sets, then we think that it could be absorbable.
Yeah.
It probably looks more dangerous than that to labor, I would say.
Because, and I guess from my perspective, you know, my experience to date is that it does the 80% accuracy or 85% accuracy pretty well. Like, it's as long as you've got somebody watching it, you know, and you can go, yeah, okay, that's going to do 80-85% of my work for me. Well, that's 5 in 6 people losing their job, you know,
yeah.
4 in 5 people losing their job at that level. So. And then the next bit, you know, getting from 80 to 81 to 82 to 83, that's going to take a long time. And exactly that's the problem driverless cars has got to is, yeah, they got to the 99% really quickly, but actually getting up, you know, 99% might sound good, but if the car's on the road for, you know, pretty much nonstop, then that's one accident every 4 days. And so, yeah, 99% isn't good enough. It needs to be, yeah, 99.99999, whatever. And that's the problem they've been having. So the pure... yeah, there's no human involved at all. We need it to be run all the time. Is difficult, and I think you'll find that in all the jobs. But the part about can I get it to do 80%? Yeah, I think that's going to come really quickly.
Yeah. So again, that's deflationary, right? So
and productivity heads in.
Which would be good, except you're pouring this into this labor-led growth model that's so disinflationary that, I mean, you know where those inputs and outputs are going to shake out precisely, but what you do know is Australia's not going to benefit like other countries will because they don't have that disproductive growth model. And so that's a headwind. It's at minimum a relative headwind to profits.
Yeah.
And possibly worse. So all that means monetary policy is going to be loose, we think, once the RBA figures all of this out. Of course, they're still making very strange noises as if they weren't there for the last 10 years as they kept things too tight and ignored, you know, low inflation and crushed wages. And hopefully they'll kind of wake up a little more swiftly this time, but
very vigilant for a wage breakout.
That is the wages in the entire developed world.
But we did possibly have one of the worst wage breakouts, 15 years ago, 17, no, longer, 17, 18 years ago.
You mean like 45 years ago?
Well, no, I was doing the mining boot.
We did for like 3 months.
Exactly. But we're scared straight now, and we're never going to allow that to
carry on.
Spend the next five decades, crushing wages.
So that means we think the Australian dollar is endemically weak as well. Now, that doesn't mean it's always weak, and in fact, I think we go through a strongish Australian dollar period right in front of us, which is one of the purposes for this potty, in fact, because we've never. Any period of rising Australian dollar is a great opportunity to get your money offshore because over the cycle, what we see is a reflection of what happened to Australia in the 1990s, where you have, you know, a technology boom driving the US and to some extent Europe, less so, but to some extent, but certainly developed markets. But Australia missing out largely because you're in the middle of a commodities bust. And in that, on that occasion, it was, you know, the post-Japan bust, which ran for 14 years through the 1990s. And so you're going to get these enormous yield differentials between Australian interest rates and international, and there's no AI winners here. I mean, yes, the services business, but no intrinsic AI winners.
There's,
we don't have
a bunch of individual. There's a bunch of individual companies who will absolutely benefit, but the broad mass of the Australian economy is not set up for. We're one of the least sophisticated countries in the world in terms of.
Yeah, and so. Yeah, I mean, we're way down on the economic sophistication list, aren't we? I can't remember how low, but it's embarrassing. Somewhere below.
Well, hundreds. It's in line with the average African country.
Yeah, it's somewhere in Africa. So, 1990s rerun, you know, gives you a currency that just doesn't stop falling. And so, you know, I'm using the 40, what have we got to 47 or something at the end of the 1990s, and I could see that repeating. And so any opportunity you get to get your assets offshore whilst the Australian dollar is stronger than that is good. And then you obviously if you write about your allocations, you're going to get the better returns in these international markets that are driven by, you know, the more profitable dimensions of the business cycle, plus big currency uplift. So that's the basic principle behind this podcast. And the only other sort of immediate winner coming out of it for Australia is sort of non-mining. Australia's infinitesimal non-mining external sector, that's exporters that aren't in mining, which would benefit from this falling currency. But, you know, they're small, and some of the big winners in that segment, you know, your sort of med tech and places like that are actually in trouble for other reasons, like CSL, ResMed, et cetera. All our headwinds around obesity drugs and peak fat and other things. So Australia's going to be a tough place to invest, basically. Over the next business cycle as we see it. But the good news is the principal adjustment mechanism for that will be the currency. And so if you're offshore during that, then it's a huge boon.
Excellent. Okay, so let's go to a quick sales message, then we'll come back on some of the sectors.
We'll be back with the investment insights very shortly. Nucleus Wealth is an active and passive investment manager. If you like what you're hearing and want some help with investing, we can do it for you via our active portfolios. Our tactical and core portfolios use the insights shared in this podcast to construct and manage your investment. We blend tactical portfolios to offer our combinations of international shares, Australian shares, government bonds, and cash. We vary the asset allocation with the goal of protecting your capital in times of market uncertainty. We also have active international.
Right, so in terms of the sectors that are most going to benefit, and to get, moving on to that theme, there's a lot of the ones that were sort of very much based on. Well, if you want exposure, you need to go offshore. So we'll start with the obesity ones. So the obesity ones, the main thing to note here is, look, obesity rates have risen dramatically over the last sort of 20 or 30 years. You know, in the US has sort of gone from sort of 10%-ish to 40%-ish in terms of the amount of obesity within that. When you look through most of the diseases that are killing people the fastest, they believe there's a pretty good correlation with being overweight. You go through, you know, talking to doctors over any one of sort of a range of different diseases, you know, if you can take the person who's got the disease and drop them 10 kilos, all of a sudden that gets rid of a whole bunch of their problems. And so this is the issue, is that, you know, most of your medical spend goes to a very small number of people, the sickest people. And so if you can take the sickest part of society and make them significantly healthier, probably, you know, not into the healthy range yet, but certainly just less extreme, then you can really lift some of that weight on the medical system. And so, yeah, it does have a big benefit for the obesity, the companies that have the obesity drugs. And again, it's not to say that we won't see some side effects or something come up, and the drugs, you know, it's not without risks, I guess. But at the moment, it very much looks as if the side effects are minimal enough that relative to the benefits, that they're, you know, they're being prescribed more than what we're actually producing. And so those companies, we think, have still got some upside, and there's still some benefit in terms of those, and they'll get better as well. Like the initial formulations were for it was all about diabetes. Now that they've actually sort of honed in on some of the key measures for this, and the key issues around weight loss, is that whether we'll start to see some improvements in terms of those drugs. There's also a fair bit more in terms of technologically on the drug front as well, around sort of customizing drugs to people, sort of better analysis now of genetic people's genetics and things like that that will allow more targeted drugs. And so there's that two sides to that. One is, yes, there's the companies who are benefiting from it, but there's also a lot of the other companies within that who are going to be losing out. A lot of the other bigger medical companies, where there's issues in terms of losing revenues and losing a lot of their best customers. Playing into this sort of same theme is life expectancy. So I've got a few charts up just sort of showing that post-COVID, we're actually still having significant excess deaths in a range of different countries around the world. And what's effectively happened very much in the second half of 2023, you know, insurance companies went from saying that, okay, we've had an excess amount of deaths from COVID, and their impression initially was a lot of the people who died were quite sick already and would have died within the next few years. So if you're looking at, say, a cohort of 50,000 people who are sick, and you're expecting to die sometime in the next 5 years, but actually most of them end up dying, you know, in the COVID years because they got COVID and died earlier, is that you would then expect a payback at some point where you've gone above trend, and so now there's actually fewer people to die next year because a lot of the sick people have already died in the prior year. Now, that was the expectation. What actually ended up happening was we actually saw those excess deaths continue into as far as 2023 and even into 2024 for some countries. And so what's effectively happened now is insurance companies have said, actually, we were wrong. This stuff's going to last much longer. And so what they've done is changed their pricing models to assume that these excess deaths are going to continue for out to 2030 or beyond for some of them. Now, so there's two sides to this. One is, can these obesity drugs actually help improve life expectancy? And we think the answer is a big yes. So we do think there'll be you'll get some positive surprises on the life expectancy side. And secondly, I guess our analysis tends to, and I guess the analysis of a number of different groups who sort of sit on the same part. When you dig into the cohorts, there's a lot of deaths in the sort of 60 to 80 range that's where most of the excess deaths seem to be. At lower ages, and the excess deaths do seem to have disappeared. And so it's a question about for us is whether the argument still stands that people who are getting COVID are dying earlier, but it's just extended out over a bigger group of people. And that effect will at some stage, have a payback, even just as people build up more natural immunity in the people who are the most susceptible. And so we do think there's a payback to the other side of that. And so if you get the double whammy of both obesity drugs helping to improve life expectancy plus the eventual normalization of the death rates from COVID, is that they're both quite positive for both the medical sector, but also insurers as well. Medical insurers is where we, and life insurers is where we think there's still some value based on those.
There's a macro angle here as well, which is, your medical costs are big drag on productivity, days off, and just generalized bad health, not working as efficiently, health costs for the government. All of these things play a marginal role and add up to quite a large cost in the economy. So I think Goldman did some analysis on the US economy where if they managed to get sort of 70 million odd people on these drugs over, say, a five-year period or over a period of time, it would actually add, you know, 2 to 3% of productive capacity to the economy. Like, it was a phenomenal number.
Yeah.
Now, you can take that with a grain of salt, but I do agree that it would be a measurable impact. And Australia will benefit from that. Like, we are obviously, you know, up there on the global obesity scale. And so that will be good. Obviously, that it also lifts labor product participation a lot as well, which is a big productivity driver. So, you know, there will, I'm not saying that there will be no benefits for the in these things for Australia, but the benefits won't outweigh the headwinds. And, you know, a place like the US, you know, stands to benefit a lot more.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And you know, and I think as well, it's an important point you're making is that it's that two-sided, isn't it? It's gone from saying, I've got somebody who's laid up in hospital and is sucking in resources, to actually that person managed to stay in their job. And so, yeah. And so it's not just a, not just the cost on one side, it's a, yeah, the double up of that.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. I will learn as well, if you're just quickly, again, as I've been saying, sort of the labor-led model in Australia, you know, being troubling in this cycle, which is all about labor efficiency, the obesity drugs are part of this as well. If it's going to lift your labor participation, then you're going to have more labor into a labor-led model. So again, you know, with this deflationary excess labor story for Australia, which is so profitless.
Yes. The next major theme we've got is sort of, well, I'm going to combine all three of them. We've done them separately in other ones, but it's electrification, onshoring, and robotics sort of all sort of bundled together. They've all got their, they all have different reasons for being involved in this. But the companies tend to actually be the same companies, is why I sort of bundle them together in a way. So there's the three themes. Is one is, increased onshoring. So China had its sort of first first negative foreign direct investment deficit for God knows how many years, 30 years, 40 years, 50 years, I don't know.
Forever,
maybe. And that's just really a sign that companies are no longer putting more factories into China. You know, that the whole, yeah, people are going to pull their supply chains out of China and into other countries is true, but it takes a long, long time. These supply chains are not quick, and this is just going to be a grinding long event for China, and positive for the companies that are helping with that onshoring, and particularly some of the robotics companies where we see, the US has got a lot of policies now trying to bring back labor and bring back manufacturing into the US and trying to support that. And generally speaking, those factories are going to be a lot more automated than what you're going to see overseas. And so, in countries like China. So it's a really trying to get hold of that. We think that's a multi-year, possibly multi-decade theme that's going to come up. Europe's in the throes of working out its subsidies and how it can get sort of in on this game as well. You know, it's been a while complaining about the US, but you know, those obviously aren't changing. And even I think if you've got a change in president, you're not looking at changes in those. So I think that manufacturing, onshoring is very much built in. And then the other one is looking at the cost of power and electrification. So, you know, I won't get too much into the climate change wars, but suffice to say, look, there is lots changing. You know, regardless of whether you're Peter Dutton and you're all in on a nuclear future, or you are moving to renewable energies or whatever it is, there's change happening within that sector. We're not as convinced about the actual producers of energy. But we do think that the cost in terms of the solar plus batteries is your sort of upper bound now in terms of saying it's very hard for prices to get above solar plus batteries, because above that, we've got this almost infinite capability to keep adding more solar and more batteries. So that cost is still in most countries above, the cost of coal or gas at more reasonable prices. But the prices we've seen in recent years, it certainly comes through. And solar itself on its own without batteries is if not the cheapest, it's cheapest in sunny countries and pretty close even in some of the countries that don't get as much sun. So what does that mean? What are we talking about there is basically we're setting this upper bound that energy prices are going to see hard to rise much beyond that. We're going to see increased electrification. And so we want companies that are actually involved, effectively selling the picks and shovels to these, is you want people who are actually doing, plugging in batteries, turning on nuclear power plants, even new gas-fired plants, whatever it is, setting up transformers, batteries, solar. You want the people that are actually doing that work and getting paid, the services companies within that. And for a large part, a lot of those companies actually tend to be companies involved in the robotics and that onshoring theme as well. So it sort of sits within that theme. The next theme we have is cloud and AI. Just going back to that theme again, it's a hard one within that robotics and offshoring. You don't get as many Australian companies in that sort of service sector and sort of companies that are advanced robotics is not a thing. Generally within the Australian market. And so, yeah, so much easier to find that theme overseas than what it is within Australia. The next one then, cloud and AI. So, look, crazy amounts of money being spent on this and the benefits of cloud computing still is quite dramatic for most companies. There's still companies still pushing stuff away from stuff that was done from systems that were done in-house and now they're moving just more and more into the cloud, and COVID has really accelerated that. A lot of this is just a utilization argument in that a company might have a computer sitting in its local environment and it's getting used 50% of the time, and then you move it now rents space on a cloud computing thing. Well, it only needs to use 50% of that, only 50%, and then the other 50% of the time, the cloud computing provider can sell that processing power and everything like that to another company. So you sort of, you halve your costs, so to speak, just on that alone, and then you get all these productivity gains from we've got specialists now, rather than some people, especially in sort of small or medium sized companies, I've got to hire all these IT guys to run my IT suite. All of a sudden, I've got people running thousands of servers and tens of thousands of servers. And so the productivity gains those people can get and the tools they can use. And so that whole AI theme, that whole cloud theme, we think already had a decent tailwind behind it. And then you add in artificial intelligence, the extra computing power is going to be needed. And the whole, I guess there's a part of it's the... just the companies who want to get involved in that. And we were spitballing this the other day, is that, there's going to be, AI is certainly beneficial from to put it to your company and make your company more productive. Some of the effect though is actually literally just going to be on companies refocusing on what they're doing. So, and what I mean by that is, we saw it very much during COVID, is that when companies are just doing their usual stay in business, doing this is what we did yesterday and the day before that, and we just keep on doing that. Every now and again, when you do get an external shock like COVID, where can people work from home? Can we save now on cloud costs or staff costs from remote working and all these things like that? That extra shock, drives companies to find different ways to do things, and often ends up in productivity gains. I actually, it's a thought of ours, one of these themes from AI, regardless of whether AI itself does it, the fact that AI is out there and companies have to re-examine their business model and worry about competitors coming in from AI and actually work out, well, what am I going to do to be more productive, given given I'm facing a threat of AI, I'm going to have to do something and spend more money on CapEx and become more productive to stave off that threat, whether or not you're using the AI yourself. And so that alone, I think, is another sort of good theme for that cloud and AI. And then the other part for those companies, obviously, is that, again, you just very hard to find that type of exposure within Australia, and especially to find the real big solid exposures. You're sort of getting more niche players if you're trying to find that in Australia. So much easier to find big companies that are more likely to be around and succeed, and certainly have a lower risk profile when you're investing overseas in those ones. Anything else on cloud and AI, Dave? We move to
you'd say there are just as there were in the 90s, you know, Australia should benefit like other developed markets from this in productivity terms and therefore national income terms. Now, as we've discussed, that's going to be weighed against by commodity prices. But again, if you're running this labor-led business model, then firstly, all of those productivity and income gains are going to accrue to capital because you have a permanent labor supply shock. So you're not going to get any broad gains from this. So, you know, it'll be quite a narrow gain in profitability for the companies that benefit. That would be, you know, the services firms plus the AI firms themselves, which are all offshore, of course. So, again, there will be benefits there, but they won't be widely shared. And so that raises a political risk of, you know, possible overregulation of AI or more regulation than elsewhere. I guess early history could tell us whether that was a good idea or a bad idea if government were to step in and prevent AI rollout.
That's an interesting feed in with one of the questions from Robert online. Just want to sort of or thoughts, I guess, from him worth putting to you, Dave, is that he's just talking about saying that you know, there's no way the union's going to allow AI to take their jobs, and I'd probably even point already to things like trains and trams, where it's quite, some of the new stuff can come in driverless, but it's actually very hard for those ones to replace existing ones, where, you know, because you'd think, for example, you know, if we're almost there on managing cars to drive around cities, then managing trams or trains, which are effectively only going in two dimensions, you stop or you go, would obviously be a lot easier. But yeah, the unions are obviously going to fight to hold on to their jobs as long as they can. You know, how do you see Australia relative to other countries in terms of union power and that whole that end of it?
Well, we have stronger unions certainly than the United States, probably the UK, probably roughly the equivalent of Europe, I guess you would say, in terms of political wherewithal. And so, you know, I would expect the unions to have an impact on the AI rollout. Yeah, I mean, I don't think they can hold back the tide with a broom, because the thing is, I mean, it works in the example of a tram, but it doesn't work in the example of an office job, because AI is in the cloud, and, you know, the office is going to go from a physical state box in a building to a module bolted onto an AI spine in Palo Alto. And there's nothing the union can do about that. So, you know, like, the unions may turn out to be more resistant in the stuff you're talking about earlier with the automation of cars, perhaps, or transport. But even there, I mean, you know, the taxis were pretty powerful until Uber just sort of ran them over. And once the consumers get a sniff of, you know,
climate prices,
and lower prices, you've lost the battle.
Yeah.
So I would think the unions will have a bit of an impact, but I think they're in real trouble with AI.
That's one more argument for, given your view on the Australian unions being sort of on par with Europe, is if you're picking countries that are going to manage the AI more smoothly, you want the countries that aren't going to hold back productivity for union reasons, don't you? So you're sort of saying that that's one more reason why the productivity growth in Australia might be slightly slower than the US or the UK, where the unions might not send up the gears as much.
Yes, but I think managing AI is really going to be all about the managing the fallout properly.
Yes,
like it's a fiscal issue, really. I think fiscal transfers is what this is going to be all about. You got to retrain.
Well, and political upheaval. Like, people don't want to work.
Don't get me wrong. If this rolls out quickly, we'll have Luddites.
Right? Yeah.
And quite rightly, people shouldn't be pissed off. Like, your job's just going to march off to Palo Alto. I'd be pissed off too. I mean, I'm watching AI devour the media supply chain and, coming more and more like a crocodile, kind of making its way up the shore towards me, and I'm wondering when I'm going to get gobbled up.
Yeah.
But if it is irresistible in a globalized world, then it will be. So you really need to be looking at fiscal transfers to make sure that it's as smooth as possible. And now, that's everything you can think of, from tax cuts to a universal basic income and everything in between, including, a lot of investment into retraining and things like that. And see, this is where the Labor-led model with immigration really gets shocked. How do you pour in hundreds of thousands of cheap foreign laborers into this environment?
Yeah.
That's just the open question for Australia, and it throws in a political risk that nobody else has, and most certainly is potentially very deflationary if they persist with it.
Yeah, except in a few key parts, houses and stuff like that, where we're creating more inflation. We spoke about that last week. We're creating more inflation than what we need. Yeah.
Well, that's right, and then you're into questions of equity as well, and fairness, because if you're going to smash entry level jobs with computers, and the end result is much lower interest rates, and you're going to offset that with more immigration to compete with more unemployed people, and the offset is then higher house prices, you are putting your younger generation absolutely to the sword.
Mm. Yeah. And arguably they've already been put to the sword. It's just,
they have. No, but I mean, well, it's dancing on their grave.
Exactly. Yeah, that's right.
It's horrific. It's a horrific outcome for youth. So, again, I'd go back to, you need a good government that knows what they're doing to lean against these things, the effects of these things, rather than try to prevent them, which I think they'll fail.
Yes.
At.
But the first they're going to try, I guess, is our assessment at the moment.
Well, they may, but unfortunately, I think we can be certain that nothing will be done until it's a god-awful mess. They'll be reactive.
Yeah.
As government, I mean, perhaps not unions, but... Government, though, they will be reactive. They won't be looking to fix anything until we're in crisis. So, no.
Excellent. One more theme, and then we'll get to some of the stuff to try and avoid. The other thing we've sort of, this is a mixture of themes that is more about the shorter term cycle, but it's also sort of got some longer term implications. Is this idea about quality stocks? And what do I mean by quality stocks is that, you can break the market, or one way that a lot of people try to break the market is the three different sections of the market. You've got growth stocks that are growing quickly and are usually priced that way, and so are quite more expensive because they're growing. You've got quality stocks, which tend to be a little bit more expensive, but they're making high margins. They've got big moats. They've got steady earnings, those types of things. And then finally, you've got your value stocks, which are cheap, but usually cheap for a reason. So more like your commodity players, they're less likely to have much pricing power. And so, and each of those different sectors performs well at different points of the cycle. And our assessment is that now is the time for quality stocks. And so quality stocks, because companies right around the world have pushed through these price rises because of inflation, and now it's about which companies can hold on to them and which are the companies that have to give it back. And so I've already said a bunch of different sectors, whether it's transport or basic commodities and things like that, that saw these massive price rises but have had to give it back because they're competitive sectors and they just can't hold on to those price rises. If I'm a tyre manufacturer and I'm selling my tyres at 50% above everyone else, well, everyone's just going to go to my competitors. So there's not enough distinction within that. And so we want the companies that are more like your Microsofts and higher quality companies like your Apples and Googles and things like that, that have got some competitive advantage and we think are going to have do a much better job at holding on to price rises. And so, we've seen this long upward. I've got a chart just sort of showing the US operating profit margin over the last sort of 30 or 40 years. And it's just this long rise, heading up and to the right. And so, for us, it's about trying to say, well, we're looking for these companies now that can hold on to those. And Australia doesn't tend to have a lot of those companies. So we do have a chunk. So we've got a lot of oligopolies and monopolies and things like that that we think will do a reasonable job at holding on to their price rises. But, the biggest sectors in Australia, the banks and resources, tend to be more value stocks than quality stocks. And they're the ones. So it's a broad sense, if Australia is sort of 50, 60% banks and resources, well, that's 50 or 60% more value stocks in Australia than what you're going to see elsewhere, where banks are typically more like 10% and resources are typically more like 1 or 2% of the overall stock market. So the idea that now is a time to be really searching out quality stocks and having those within your portfolio, that's sort of one more reason for going off overseas.
And I'll just add to that, the economy that we're forecasting here, I mean, obviously miners are in trouble, big trouble in terms of the big miners are in big trouble in terms of the wind down of Chinese growth and big falls to coming bulk commodities. But the economy that delivers that is so deflationary and gives you immense rate cuts is a real bank killer as well. I don't mean it's going to kill the banks, but margins. If interest rates are going to fall much further here than elsewhere, then bank margins are going to fall much further as well.
Yeah.
So it challenges profit growth at banks quite a lot.
Yeah. And I think, we've sort of come reluctantly to the conclusion over time that that banks are now largely sort of government supported or certainly regulator supported around a lot of the world. And the Aussie banks are earning great margins. They've done a much better job at being close to the regulators and getting higher returns. It's sort of two-sided to that. As a fundamental, we've got problems and it could be much more devastating if Australia actually regulated the banks a fair bit more. But I think,
that certainly won't happen.
No, that's right. We had a major bloody Royal Commission into it.
You just got the hard constraint of net interest margins is all.
Yeah, that's right.
A problem for the banks. So, I'm not necessarily talking about falling profits, but they're going to find it hard to lift them.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll go to a quick message, and then we'll jump back with some of these the sectors to avoid.
We'll be back again shortly. If you like what you're hearing but want a low-cost passive option, Nucleus Wealth is the first to offer passive direct indexing in Australia. The first generation of passive investing was index funds. The next gen was ETFs. Now, direct indexing is here with significantly more customization and control. The benefit of direct indexing is you can add or subtract investment themes, and we have almost 100 different options to choose from. For example, you could buy an international share direct index portfolio that excludes fossil fuels and arms manufacturers and has a tilt towards cybersecurity and cloud computing. Alternatively, you could buy a portfolio with no screens and an extra exposure to nuclear power and defense contractors. You can find out more at nucleuswealth.com. Now back to the show.
Her doctrine.
Sorry.
Okay.
Dave's just giving away his secrets in the background.
Yes.
Okay, so yes. Now I wanted to jump to some of the themes to avoid. Actually, before I do that, though, I just want to highlight as well, we do have this conference coming up next week in both Melbourne and Sydney for direct indexing. So anyone who's interested in that, you can jump on the Nucleus site or the MB site and Macro Business site and register for that. So yeah, as part of the Nucleus as a sponsor, you can get some free tickets to that, which we think is really the next generation of investing for Australia. So certainly anyone, particularly anyone involved in any way in sort of an intermediary markets, you know, accountants and financial planners, you know, this is, I think, very important to get on top of that theme. Anyway, so themes to avoid. The big ones, I'll just run through this quickly and then we'll jump onto the overall investment views and some of the questions we've had. China in terminal decline is our number one theme. So really, as we've alluded to it a few times and we've spoken about a lot on prior podcasts, but this idea that China is very much headed to be Japan 2.0, potentially just faster and with worse demographics, is alive and well. And you know, avoiding stocks that are involved in there. Driverless cars, electric vehicles. So we're certainly interested in both these as large as overall thematics, and we're interested in the whole what it's going to do for society. We're just not convinced of the investment merits of those at the moment. Either that, you know, the technologically you're not quite sure who's going to succeed and when, but also the electric vehicles. You know, it is very much about getting that cost down significantly. So there's still costs are still too high to really compete properly with combustion engines. And so while we think they will keep selling and keep being subsidized and all that, the investment prospects aren't as good, and there's a price war going on in China. China's picked this as one of the sectors it's going to spend a lot of money subsidizing, trying to get as many electric vehicles out to the rest of the world as they can. They've been very successful in terms of selling the cars, but their profitability and the profitability for the rest of the world is not boding well. Stocks that have to give back those margin gains, so the sort of more the value stocks, stocks that are going to continue to suffer from the continued bust we're seeing in the office market. And stocks on the other side of that obesity is the trade. They're all ones where we're busy trying to avoid. Dave, any other thoughts on those? And then I've got a couple of questions from readers to fire off at you.
No, swing to the readers.
Yep. So the main one from Jude. So question of, I think we've had this, a vague theme of this on in time, but it's probably increased in current things. So he's asking, we really don't want to have to sell our Nucleus investments to buy a $1 million mortgage in Sydney. Do we just leave Australia for a more complex economy that doesn't run crazy migration? And let's just highlight it. It ain't New Zealand. Is it the same? Running the same employee?
Well, I mean, I obviously can't really answer that with any authority. I don't know you or any of your circumstances. I mean, what I would say, I suppose, is I think the Aussie dollar's going a lot lower, so. Earning US dollars or similar euro even would be great.
Yeah,
for the coming decade.
And playing right into the theme of this whole thing is if your money is in international investments or a large part of your money is in international investments, then you might have the option to move countries. Whereas if you've bundled all your money into Aussie assets, then maybe you won't have the option to move countries because the Aussie dollar falls 30% and all of a sudden you can't, you know.
Yes, it's quite right. I mean, that's about all I can offer on that.
Yeah, no worries. So is any other investment thoughts, Dave, before we finish up?
You had another question?
No, I think I've already answered those ones. Yeah.
No, if I, to the extent that I would be keeping money here, I would have it in bonds and, you know, the externally exposed non-mining stocks and that. That'd be about it.
Excellent. Well, thanks everyone for listening in. I would just like to note that you can grab all our podcasts across most major and minor podcast platforms, Google, Apple, Spotify, and a whole bunch of the minor ones are all there as well. If you want to connect with us, either jump on the website at nucleuswealth.com/contact. If you've got any thoughts, leave some comments. We'd love, you know, comments and likes. And we're on a whole bunch of different social media as well if you want to follow us on those. Thanks, everyone, for listening in, and we'll see you again next week, 12:30 on Thursday.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dave.